The title of your lecture kind of took me off guard. Good nutrition and climate change, steps we all can take. So we've heard a lot about climate change, but can you explain for me what good nutrition has to do with climate change?
Yes, we have a report from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization out of Rome about a year ago called The Long Shadow of Animal Husbandry. And it turns out that the high meat diet that characterizes the American diet and Western Europe and increasingly even middle-income countries around the world, as people have more money, they tend to want to eat more meat. And the production of meat for human consumption is a major source of greenhouse gases. And by cutting back on meat, not only will we lessen carbon emissions, it's not actually, I'll come back to the carbon emissions in a moment, because it's the other greenhouse gases associated with meat production, methane and nitrous oxide, that are actually far more potent as heat-trapping gases than carbon dioxide.
But wait a second. Back up here for me a second. You're
okay.
Saying that producing livestock creates greenhouse gases?
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, ruminants, beef cattle and dairy cattle, produce a great deal of methane. And methane, on a molecule-for-molecule basis, has 18 times the heat-trapping capacity of carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide coming out of the tailpipe of your automobile is an important greenhouse gas, but it's a weak link compared to the methane being belched up by the cattle grazing on the green pastures in North Carolina, getting ready to be eaten as steaks and rump roasts and hamburger.
But we've had livestock, we've had cattle for ever. I mean, you know, since for many, 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 many centuries. So,
yes.
How do we now say, okay, well, livestock are as bad as driving your car?
Worse than driving your car is what I'm saying, not as bad. We haven't had the animals in the numbers that are currently being consumed. Every year in the United States, we raise, kill, and consume 9 billion, that's billion with a B, animals in the United States. Now, it's true that most of them are chickens, about 8 billion broilers and a smaller number of turkeys and so on. But we raise and consume 35 million head of cattle and 135 million swine every year in the United States. And in order to produce that amount of meat for human consumption, about 65% of the average American's intake of dietary protein is from animal sources, compared to an average around the world of about 30%. And according to our own U.S. Department of Agriculture, the average American male is now consuming about 185% of recommended daily allotment of meat, and the average woman about 140%. So we're way off the scale. And the problem is that with the production of meat, especially in our modern industrialized food animal production system, we end up with amounts of methane and nitrous oxide being released into the environment that are totally different from what was present 150 or 200 years ago.
So you say, what you're saying is that we should be eating less meat, preferably, especially less livestock, less pork,
yes.
Less beef.
Yes.
In
order to reduce the greenhouse gas production, but also in order to reduce the total amount of saturated fat in our diet. So it would have a beneficial public health impact in terms of improving the American diet, and it would have a beneficial environmental impact in terms of lessening our carbon footprint or our greenhouse gas footprint.
Now, Dr. Lawrence, this would seem to kind of throw a wrench into everything we've been hearing, or we're sort of being trained to think right now about climate change, because You know, I'm told to think about how often I drive my car and how often I turn the lights on at my house or to replace the bulbs with compact fluorescents. But you're saying before I do any of that, I should think about how much I steak I have?
Well, not before, at the same time.
Hmm.
What FAO estimates is that the animal husbandry sector of the global economy is responsible for about 18% of greenhouse gas emissions. Now, that's larger than any other single sector. It's larger than the transportation sector. But it's the accumulation of all of these ways in which our industrialized societies are putting carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide into the atmosphere that are contributing to global climate change. But the average individual person, and I could put it to you, do you feel as though you have a handle on the lever that can change policy about coal-burning power plants in the Midwest? And if you're like me, you probably say, well,
absolutely not.
Not likely. But you have a choice about what you're going to eat tonight. And instead of eating an 8-ounce steak, if you had a 3-ounce portion, if instead of eating meat every day, you had meat on 2 or 3 days a week, it's going to take all of these small incremental steps by all of us to begin to make a dent in greenhouse gas production. But there are very few other things. Well, actually getting out of your car and walking to work or walking to public transportation would be good for your health and for the climate. But changing your diet is good for your health and the climate. And one of the things that we're trying to do at the Center for a Livable Future is find out how can we help people make those daily decisions that can be good for themselves as well as good for the larger society. And we think that dietary change, physical activity, support of public transportation, changing the incandescent bulb for a high energy-saving compact fluorescent, all of those are the kinds of individual decisions that we need to educate people about.
Doctor, can you clarify for me, is it all meats or poultry and fish? Do they produce less of these methane gases and so forth than livestock and pork do?
Well, that's an important clarification. Poultry themselves are not big methane producers, but raising the grain to feed the poultry is an important source of nitrous oxide. So it's the intensive agriculture associated with our high meat diet that is responsible. But if I had to single out the worst offender, it would be the category of ruminants, the dairy cattle and the beef cattle. Pigs less and poultry even less. There's a step down of inefficiency, however. It takes about 7 tons of grain to produce a ton of beef, and it takes about 4 tons of grain to produce a ton of pork, and only 2 tons of grain to produce a ton of chicken. So in terms of feed conversion to edible protein, poultry the most efficient. In terms of inefficiency coupled with high production of methane, beef are the worst offenders. And there's growing evidence that probably of all the kinds of meat that we ingest, red meat is the least healthy.
And I guess the other thing, too, would be this concept of eating locally. I'm sure that
yes.
figures into your
right.
your presentation as well.
It does. Food miles or becoming a locavore, as somebody has said. I can't remember whether that was Barbara Kingsolver or Michael Pollan, but somebody has coined the term being a locavore. So in a state like North Carolina, where there's still a large amount of fertile, productive farmland available, encouraging local agriculture, community-supported agriculture, or CSAs, where groups of citizens pay a farmer in advance for a share in whatever fruits and vegetables are raised, all of those things can reduce the amount of fossil fuels that are required to transport food great distances. There was an interesting study a few years ago in Washington, D.C. A group of investigators went into a local grocery store and used what the U.S. Department of Agriculture calls a standard market basket, and they filled it, and then they tried to figure out how far each of the food items had traveled. The average distance was 1,500 miles. So if you think of, you know,
for $4, a can of beans or something,
$4 a gallon diesel in a 18-wheeler hauling food 1,500 miles to your local grocery store versus the local farmer, who might have to charge a little bit more, but you know that you're doing a good thing for your local regional economy, you're doing a good thing for the environment, and it's going to take a pretty fundamental shift, though, in the way we think about convenience and all the other aspects of our modern life.
I'm curious, Doctor, if you think we're, economically speaking, possibly getting to the point where, you know, for a long time, eating locally hasn't always been the most cost-effective option. You know, I mean, a lot of times the bananas shipped in from Bolivia or wherever they're grown are a lot cheaper than, you know, the bananas that might be grown a little closer to you in the U.S. So, but with the cost of gas and the cost of energy rising, are we getting closer to the point where it may not always be the case that you're better off buying stuff from a long ways away?
I think that's right. Now, it is complicated because there are certain things that, and bananas and coffee are good examples that are not available locally just because of climate and what you require to grow things like that. There are also certain things that when shipped by container ship, the number of tons per gallon of fossil fuel needed to transport a whole shipload of bananas may be a lot less than the amount of gas that would be burned up by a whole fleet of small trucks moving local produce around at different orders of scale. So a lot of work is being done just trying to figure out what the optimal balance might be. But we're beginning to realize that a lot of very, very productive land is close to our large cities, and with the support of regional food nets and better farm policies, the small and medium farmer has been left out of the picture for too long with the huge commodity subsidies that go to the giant agribusinesses in the United States. So there are efforts that could be achieved by shifting the balance a little bit more in favor of the small grower, capturing what are called externalities, that the actual cost of the food in the marketplace doesn't capture the cost to the environment. And if we begin to have something like a carbon tax or a carbon cap and trade policy that begins to have the total cost of the things we consume reflected in the price, then some of the local products will become much more competitive.
Dr. Lawrence, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.